wealth you do have. Keep cash in discreet places, such as a money belt, a sock, or a hidden pocket. And be wary of public distractions and dense crowds, as this is where pickpockets tend to operate. When staying at a hostel or guest house, keep your extra cash in the safe and write out an itemized receipt with the clerk to ensure that everything is in order when it comes to retrieve your things. In tourist areas, be wary of pushy new friends who insist on giving you free shopping or sightseeing tours. Don't fall into quick money schemes with locals or travelers that entail gem or carpet export, duty-free resales, exchange rate margins, or drugs, as these are all time-honored scams. Don't wander around drunk at night, and don't let nosy locals know that you've been in their country for only a few days. This marks you as an easy sucker for con artists. Better to fudge a bit and claim that you've been there for a month. In maintaining this awareness against theft and scams, don't overcompensate and fall into knee-jerk paranoia, a sure way to ruin your experience anywhere. Instead, cultivate a simple and instinctive habit of diligence as you travel. I'm writing this book in a peaceful residential hotel in southern Thailand, for instance, but I always padlock my door when I leave my room. I simply find it easier to keep a habit of caution than to continuously try and guess when things are and are not safe. Though prevention and diligence go a long way, of course, there is no foolproof method against misadventure on the road. Should sickness or crime catch you off guard, the best response is to humbly accept these things as a part of life's adventure. Life has no other discipline to impose, if we would but realize it, than to accept life unquestioningly, wrote Henry Miller. Everything we deny, denigrate, or despise serves to defeat us in the end. What seems nasty, painful, evil can become a source of beauty, joy, and strength if faced with an open mind. Every moment is golden for him who has the vision to realize it as such. Once you actualize this vision, in good fortune and bad, you'll be able to discover and explore a whole new kind of terra incognita within yourself. Vagabonding Profile, The Pioneering Women of Vagabonding. Historically, adventure travel is too often seen as the exclusive pursuit of rugged men, from Richard Burton to Ernest Shackleton to Edmund Hillary. A quick review of travel accounts from the last 250 years, however, reveals that many of history's most intrepid and insightful adventurers were women. Mary Wollstonecraft, Isabella Lucy Bird, Alexandra David Neal, Mary Kingsley, Freya Stark, Frances Trollope, Amelia Edwards, Emily Hahn, Ida Pfeiffer, Rosita Forbes, Rose Wilder Lane, Rebecca West, and Martha Gellhorn represent a mere sampling of women who won renown for their adventures. They traveled to places as far-flung as Arabia and the Arctic, Africa and the American frontier. In addition to shattering the stereotype that brawn and machismo are prerequisites to striking off into the wilderness, these female explorers also found adventure in the human encounters and simple day-to-day unknown. Isabel Eberhardt, who explored North Africa in the 19th century, unapologetically summed up the logic that fired these pioneering women vagabonders. The cowardly belief that a person must stay in one place is too reminiscent of the unquestioning resignation of animals, beasts of burden stupefied by servitude, and yet always willing to accept the slipping on of the harness. There are limits to every domain and laws to govern every organized power, but the vagrant owns the whole vast earth that ends only at the non-existent horizon, and her empire is an intangible one, for her domination and enjoyment of it are things of the spirit. Vagabonding Voices, Chapter 7.
Hi, I'm Kristen Mancosa, a 24-year-old freelance writer from Erie, Pennsylvania. Adventure, at least for me, is the idea of a life beyond the walls of a cubicle and outside of the realm of 9-to-5s. It's the feeling of being humbled by what you have and awed by what the world really is and has to offer.
This is James Ulrich, a 34-year-old freelance travel writer from Seattle. Seeking a more nuanced definition of adventure can lead to unforgettably rich travel experiences. Can't run with the bulls? Can't cross the Sahara? Try doing something that you may find every bit as daunting. Making friends out of strangers, connecting with the locals instead. Open your mind to the possibilities of a new connection. You'll be rewarded with a much deeper perspective of the culture you came so far to experience. And long after the adventurers are nursing their sunburns and snake bites, you'll have friends for a lifetime and threads of their culture woven into your own life's tapestry.
This is Wendy Wrangham, a 42-year-old writer from England. Life is adventure. Travel is adventure with a different address. Seek and you shall find is not an adage that works in this case. Adventure has a way of finding people, and some people it finds more often than others.
Quotes for Chapter 7. George Santayana, The Philosophy of Travel. We need sometimes to escape into open solitudes, into aimlessness, into the moral holiday of running some pure hazard in order to sharpen the edge of life, to taste hardship, and to be compelled to work desperately for a moment, no matter what. Claude Levi Strauss, Triste to a Peak. Exploration is not so much a covering of surface distance as a study in depth. A fleeting episode, a fragment of landscape, or a remark overheard may provide the only means of understanding and interpreting areas which would otherwise remain barren of meaning. Henry David Thoreau, Walden. Rise free from care before dawn and seek adventures. Let the moon find thee by other lakes, and the night overtake thee everywhere at home. There are no larger fields than these, no worthier games than may here be played. Aristotle, Ethics. The man who is truly good and wise will bear with dignity whatever fortune sends, and will always make the best of his circumstances. Théophile Gautier, Wanderings in Spain. The pleasure in traveling consists of the obstacles, the fatigue, and even the danger. What charm can anyone find in an excursion when he is always sure of reaching his destination, of having horses ready waiting for him, a soft bed, an excellent supper, and all of the eases and comforts he can enjoy in his own home? One of the great misfortunes of modern life is the want of any sudden surprise and the absence of all adventures. Everything is so well arranged. Rilke, Letters to a Young Poet. We have no reason to mistrust our world, for it is not against us. Has it terrors? They are our terrors. Has it abysses? Those abysses belong to us. Are dangers at hand? We must try to love them. How should we be able to forget those ancient myths about dragons that at the last moment turn into princesses? Perhaps all the dragons of our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us once beautiful and brave. Tip Sheet, Chapter 7. Please visit vagabonding.net/resources for up-to-date resources on travel, health, and safety. Part 4, The Long Run. Chapter 8, Keep It Real. Though now considered to be one of the great monuments of ancient civilization, the lost city of Angkor was not even known to the Western world until French travelers began exploring Cambodia in the mid-19th century. Contrary to popular belief, the massive, awe-inspiring Khmer ruins were first discovered and documented not by explorer Henri Mouhot, but by Charles-Émile Bolliveau, a French priest who visited the site in 1850. Having been trained in the strict ways of piety, Bolliveau was somewhat horrified by the sight of the ancient stone city with its voluptuous sculptures and pagan motifs. One year after Bolliveau published his weak-kneed observations in Paris, Mouhot stumbled across Angkor and viewed the ancient city not through the eyes of his discipline, he was a naturalist, but with naive eyes of wonder and curiosity. When Mouhot's travel account was eventually published, the public shared in his exuberance, and Angkor has been the site of archaeological study and pilgrimage ever since. In recounting this story, it's tempting to write off Father Bolliveau as a pious nitwit, but most of us tend to make the same mistakes when we travel. Just like the stuffy French priest, we tend to view our new surroundings through the petty prejudices of home rather than seeing things for what they are. Our eyes find it easier on a given occasion to produce a picture already often produced than to seize upon the divergence and novelty of an impression, wrote Friedrich Nietzsche. It is difficult and painful for the ear to listen to anything new. We hear strange music badly. Unlike Bolliveau, most of us don't stand to lose our place in the history books if we misinterpret the discoveries of our travels. Nonetheless, it's important, even on a personal level, to not just look at things as we travel, but to see things for what they are. The difference between looking and seeing on the road is frequently summed up with two somewhat opposable terms, tourist and traveler. According to this distinction, travelers are the ones who truly see their surroundings, whereas tourists just superficially look at attractions. Tourists, moreover, are thought to lack depth and taste, and their pursuits are considered inauthentic and dehumanized. Travelers, interested and engaged, are exactly the opposite. For the past century or so, critics and travel writers have fleshed out this tourist-traveler contrast with an entire canon of aphorisms. The traveler sees what he sees, wrote G.K. Chesterton in the 1920s. The tourist sees what he has come to see. The traveler was active. He went strenuously in search of people, of adventure, of experience, Daniel Boorstin opined in 1961. The tourist is passive. He expects interesting things to happen to him. Tourists don't know where they've been, observed Paul Theroux 20 years ago. Travelers don't know where they're going. Travelers are those who leave their assumptions at home, and tourists are those who don't, wrote Pico Iyer in 2000. These are all apt observations, of course, but they have inadvertently contributed to an odd perversion of the very idea they're trying to communicate. Indeed, so well known is the rhetorical difference between tourists, whom we scorn, and travelers, whom we want to be, that the distinction has turned into a social exercise instead of an experiential one. Once, while hanging out in Dahab, Egypt, I talked to a British fellow who had nothing but contempt for what he called tourists. They all fly straight to Sharm el-Sheikh, a ritzy resort town near Dahab, and spend their time in luxury hotels, he said. They might take an aircon bus to see Mount Sinai, but apart from that, they just sunbathe and eat pizza like they could at home. None of them really experience Egypt. I agreed that this kind of travel left a lot to be desired, but the more the guy talked, the more I wondered how he considered himself any different. In 4 months of travel, he'd spent 3.5 months living in a reed hut in Dahab, and he'd spent most of his time there scuba diving and smoking dope with other travelers. The only lifestyle difference I could discern between him and the tourists of Sharm el-Sheikh was that he ate falafel, wore a black checkered Arab keffiyeh, and survived on $8 a day instead of $200. I mention this not to condemn the guy's lifestyle, but to point out how the tourist-traveler distinction has largely degenerated into a cliquish sort of fashion dichotomy. Instead of seeking the challenges that true travel requires, we can simply point to a few stereotypical tourists, make some jokes at their expense, and consider ourselves travelers by default. In reality, travel is not a social contest, and vagabonding has never represented a caste on the tourist-traveler hierarchy. Depending upon circumstances, a sincere vagabonder could variously be called a traveler or a tourist, a pilgrim or a satyr, a victor or a victim, an individual seeker or a demographic trend. Indeed, the main conceit in trying to distinguish travelers from tourists is that you end up with a flimsy facade of presumed insiders and outsiders. By the vacuous standards of fashion, insiders and outsiders are necessary, but in the realm of travel, where by definition you are always a guest in foreign places, such a distinction is ridiculous. Putting on a cocksure and superior air might win you points at a nightclub in your hometown, but such pretense on the road will only cheapen your travel experience. Instead of worrying about whether you're a tourist or a traveler, the secret to seeing your surroundings on the road is simply to keep things real. On the surface, this seems like a simple enough proposition. Wherever you go, there you are, says a silly adage, and simply being there shouldn't be a very tough task. The thing is, few of us ever are where we are. Instead of experiencing the reality of a moment or a day, our minds and souls are elsewhere, obsessing on the past or the future, fretting and fantasizing about other situations. At home, this is one way of dealing with day-to-day doldrums. On the road, it's a sure way to miss out on the very experiences that stand to teach you something. This is why vagabonding is not to be confused with a mere vacation where the only goal is escape. With escape in mind, vacationers tend to approach their holiday with a grim resolve, determined to make their experiences live up to their expectations. On the vagabonding road, you prepare for the long haul knowing that the predictable and the unpredictable, the pleasant and the unpleasant, are not separate, but part of the same ongoing reality. You can try to make vagabonding conform to your fantasies, of course, but this strategy has a way of making travel irrelevant. Indeed, vagabonding is, at its best, a rediscovery of reality itself. Thus, as the initial days of your travel experience stretch into weeks and months, you should let go of your pre-trip stereotypes and exchange two-dimensional expectations for living people, living places, and living life. This process is the only way to break through the static postcard fantasy and emerge into the intense beauty of the real. In this way, seeing as you travel is somewhat of a spiritual exercise, a process not of seeking interesting surroundings, but of being continually interested in whatever surrounds you. In many ways, embracing reality is daunting, not because of its hazards, but because of its complexities. Thus, the best way to confront reality is not with a set method of interpretation, which will allow you to recognize only patterns you already know, but with a sincere attitude of open-mindedness. The challenge in cultivating open-mindedness, of course, is that this very notion can get confused before you ever leave home. While traveling in the Middle East, for instance, I once met a Canadian woman who just traveled to a remote Syrian Catholic monastery in the gorgeous desert mountains outside of Damascus. Not only had she enjoyed her 3-day visit, she told me, but she'd also managed to hold on to her free-thinking principles by steadfastly refusing the monk's offers to join the daily church service. Somehow this attitude struck me as a bit skewed. In the conformist confines of small-town Alberta, refusing to go to church might be a sign of liberation, but as the guest of an isolated Syrian monastery, one that you've taken great pains to visit, no less, refusing to go to church is not merely narrow-minded, but rude. It's important to remember that what passes for cultural open-mindedness at home won't always apply wholesale to your travels. Indeed, you might live in Chinatown, dance to Fela Kuti tunes, wear a sarong, practice the didgeridoo, date an Estonian-American, and eat enchiladas in New York, but that doesn't necessarily mean you know squat about how the people of China, Nigeria, Thailand, Australia, Estonia, or Mexico live and think. Interestingly, one of the initial impediments to open-mindedness is not ignorance, but ideology. This is especially true in America, where, particularly in progressive circles, we have politicized open-mindedness to the point that it isn't so open-minded anymore. Indeed, regardless of whether your sympathies lean to the left or the right, you aren't going to learn anything new if you continually use politics as a lens through which to view the world. At home, political convictions are a tool for getting things done within your community. On the road, political convictions are a clumsy set of experiential blinders, compelling you to seek evidence for conclusions you've already drawn. This is not to say that holding political beliefs is wrong. It's just that politics are naturally reductive and the world is infinitely complex. Cling too fiercely to your ideologies and you'll miss the subtle realities that politics can't address. You'll also miss the chance to learn from people who don't share your worldview. If a Japanese college student tells you that finding a good husband is more important than feminist independence, she is not contradicting your world so much as giving you an opportunity to see hers. If a Paraguayan barber insists that dictatorship is superior to democracy, you might just learn something by putting yourself in his shoes and hearing him out. In this way, open-mindedness is a process of listening and considering, of muting your compulsion to judge what is right and wrong, good and bad, proper and improper, and having the tolerance and patience to try and see things for what they are. Another ironic impediment to reality is the very idealism that inspires us to travel in the first place. In our travel daydreams, we transport ourselves to places that we believe will be prettier, purer, and simpler than what we encounter at home. When these idealized conditions prove less than real, however, we tend to cling to our daydreams instead of fully engaging reality. In some cases, such as the ethno-tourism villages I discussed earlier, we cheat reality by overlooking the details, blue jeans or cell phones, that don't match up to our pre-modern ideals. In other cases, the naive optimism we bring into travel causes us to ultimately disdain the very cultures we'd idealized. When I was living in Busan, for example, I met many expatriate teachers who'd moved overseas to experience another culture, only to become embittered when they discovered that Korean culture can be downright cutthroat and workaholic. These folks were experiencing another culture all right, but their myopic idealism backfired on them when they realized that an Asian society could be just as frenetic and impersonal as their own. In this way, any idealized search for the other threatens disappointment in a world where the other can often resemble home. Just as skepticism should not be confused with cynicism, however, embracing realism need not be confused with falling into pessimism. One particularly potent strain of traveler pessimism is the notion that modern influences are destroying native societies, or that certain cultures were more real sometime in the not-too-distant past. According to this assumption, any given society, Kuna or Bedouin or Maasai, was somehow better 20 years ago, before it was spoiled. What such reflexive pessimism overlooks, of course, is that societies have always changed and that tradition is a dynamic phenomenon. The evaluation of tourism cannot be accomplished against a static background, wrote tourism scholar David J. Greenwood. Much of what we see as destruction is construction, some as the result of a lack of any other viable option, and some the result of choices that could be made differently. Beyond this, much of our concern about the evils of change within pre-modern cultures is less an interest in the quality of local life than in our own desire to experience an untainted culture. As anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss pointed out 50 years ago, mourning the perceived purity of yesterday will only cause us to miss out on the true dynamic of today. While I complain of being able to glimpse no more than a shadow of the past, he wrote in Triste Tropique, I may be insensitive to reality as it is taking shape at this very moment. a few hundred years hence, in this same place, another traveler as despairing as myself will mourn the disappearance of what I might have seen but failed to see. Thus, the purest way to see a culture is simply to accept and experience it as it is now, even if you have to put up with satellite dishes in Kazakhstan, cyber cafes in Malawi, and fast food restaurants in Belize. After all, as Thomas Merton reported when asked if he'd seen the real Asia during his trip to India, it's all real, as far as I can see. One final reality-numbing process worth mentioning is the pursuit of fun on the road. Fun, of course, can be had in any given moment of your travels, but I'm thinking specifically about that bedrock institution of fun, partying. To be sure, your travels won't be the same if you don't occasionally take time to put on a buzz, let your inhibitions down, and get to know new people. When you first hit the road, in fact, you probably won't be able to party enough, as the company will seem superb, the drinks cheap, and the settings perfect. As you get past the first few weeks of your travel experience, however, you'll discover that partying on the road is different from partying at home. At home, partying is a way of celebrating the weekend or taking a pause from the workaday world. On the road, every day is a weekend, every moment a break from the workaday world. Thus, falling into a nightly ritual of partying, as can easily happen at traveler hangouts anywhere on the planet, is a sure way to overlook the subtlety of places, stunt your travel creativity, and trap yourself in the patterns of home. Granted, you can have plenty of fun in the process, but if you travel the world merely to indulge in the same kinds of diversions you enjoy at home, you'll end up selling your vagabonding experience short. Of all the intoxicants you can find on the road, including a national beer for nearly every country in the world, marijuana deserves a particular mention here, primarily because it's so popular with travelers. Much of this popularity is due to the fact that marijuana is a relatively harmless diversion, again, provided you aren't caught with it, that can intensify certain impressions and sensations of travel. The problem with marijuana, however, is that it's the travel equivalent of watching television. It replaces real sensations with artificially enhanced ones. Because it doesn't force you to work for a feeling, it creates passive experiences that are only vaguely connected to the rest of your life. The drug vision remains a sort of dream that cannot be brought over into daily life, wrote Peter Matheson in The Snow Leopard. Old mists may be banished, that is true, but the alien chemical agent forms another mist, maintaining the separation of the I from the true experience of the one. Moreover, chemical highs have a way of distracting you from the utterly stoning natural high of travel itself. After all, roasting a bowl might spice up a random afternoon in Dayton, Ohio, but is it really all that necessary along the Sumatran shores of Lake Toba, the mountain basins of Nepal, or the desert plateaus of Patagonia? As Salvador Dali quipped, "I never took drugs because I am drugs." With this in mind, strive to be drugs as you travel, to patiently embrace the raw personal sensation of unmediated reality, an experience far more affecting than any intoxicant can promise. Vagabonding Profile, Ed Byrne. In the 1970s, when counterculture excesses threatened to degrade Jack Kerouac's ecstatic road visions into a self-indulgent caricature, Ed Byrne's offbeat travel guides redeemed independent travel for everyday vagabonders. Mixing inspiration with down-to-earth advice, Byrne's Vagabonding in Europe and North Africa and Vagabonding in the USA inspired a generation of travelers to disregard the clichés of fashion and seek the simple joy of direct experience on the road. Raised in New Jersey and Florida by Polish immigrant parents, Byrne has over the course of his life been a sailor, a professional photographer, a publisher, a writer, an editor, a designer, and a poet. In Vagabonding in Europe and North Africa, Byrne underscored that long-term travel is not the exclusive realm of rebels and mystics, but is open to anyone willing to embrace the vivid textures of reality. We all have stuck in us deep somewhere a keenness for excitement, a savoring for the kooky, a leap-for-life outlook. From this comes the catalytic impetus, without which all other requirements mean nothing. Everyday types are as likely to have this sine qua non as the obvious icon kickers. The person who strikes off for himself is no hero, nor necessarily even unconventional, but to a greater degree than most people, he or she thinks and acts independently. The vagabond frees in himself the latent urge to live closer to the edge of experience. Vagabonding Voices, Chapter 8.
I'm Daniel Harbeck, a 43-year-old instructional designer from Bartlett, Illinois. The key to keeping your travels real is to shed extra baggage, dismiss predefined notions, and leave limiting walls behind. It's leaving behind the wristwatch manacle to live by the inner clock. It's finding pieces of your soul in remote corners of the world.
This is Aaron Atencio, a 33-year-old avid world traveler from Colorado. Too often, travelers pride themselves on avoiding touristy places. Remember that just about every major tourist spot is popular for a good reason. Yes, tourists flock there now in droves, alongside tacky souvenirs and inflated prices. But strive to be the kind of traveler who can look past that and see the draw of the location for its original appeal. You're traveling in a time where very few places are left in this world that have yet to be discovered. Finding a perfect, isolated spot may be a challenge, but seeking a perfect experience or local connection will lead to a much richer experience.
This is Tim Ferriss, a 36-year-old author from San Francisco, California. This is a long one, so bear with me. I did a year and a half of travel around the world and had my own existential crises. So here goes. Let's suppose that you decide to dip your toe in dreams like relocating to the Caribbean for island hopping or taking a safari in the Serengeti. It will be wonderful, unforgettable, amazing, and you should totally do it. There will come a time, however, be it 3 weeks or 3 months later, when you won't be able to drink another damn piña colada or photograph another red-assed baboon. That day will come. Self-criticism and existential panic attacks usually start around this time. You'll say to yourself, but this is what I always wanted. How could I be bored? Oh my God, what am I going to do with myself? So try not to freak out and fuel the fire. This is totally normal among all high performers who downshift after working hard for a long time. The smarter and more goal-oriented you are, the tougher these growing pains will be. Don't be afraid of the existential or social challenges. You may feel somewhat isolated. You may feel like you can't relate to your peers back home. Freedom is like a new sport. In the beginning, the sheer newness of it is exciting enough to keep things interesting at all times. Once you've learned the basics, though, it becomes clear that having less work is easy. It's filling the void with more life that is hard. Finding excitement, as it turns out, takes more thought than simple workaholism. But don't fret. That's where all the rewards are. So keep it up.
Quotes, Chapter 8. Walt Whitman, by Blue Ontario's Shore. Piety and conformity to them that like, I am he who tauntingly compels men, women, nations, crying, leap from your seats and contend for your lives. Who are you that wanted only to be told what you knew before? Who are you who wanted only a book to join you in your nonsense? Samuel Johnson, from the Anecdotes of Samuel Johnson. The use of traveling is to regulate imagination by reality, and instead of thinking how things may be, to see them as they really are. John Muir, The Wilderness World of John Muir. Most people are on the world, not in it, having no conscious sympathy or relationship to anything about them. Undiffused, separate, and rigidly alone like marbles of polished stone, touching but separate. Robert Louis Stevenson, from Travels with a Donkey. For my part, I travel not to go anywhere, but to go. I travel for travel's sake. The great affair is to move, to feel the needs and hitches of our life more nearly, to come down off this featherbed of civilization and find the globe granite underfoot and strewn with cutting flints. Leroy Jones, from A Political Poem. Luxury, then, is a way of being ignorant, comfortably. From the Bhagavad Gita, the unreal never is, the real never is not. This truth indeed has been seen by those who can see the true. Michael Crichton, Travels. Often I go to some distant region of the world to be reminded of who I really am. Stripped of your ordinary surroundings, your friends, your daily routines, your refrigerator full of your food, your closet full of your clothes, you are forced into direct experience. Such direct experience inevitably makes you aware of who it is that is having the experience. That's not always comfortable, but it is always invigorating. Tip Sheet, Chapter 8. All too often, responsible travel is a notion that gets hijacked by ecotourism marketers and political demagogues. Fortunately, responsible travel doesn't require that you become an ecotour client or a shrill activist. Rather, conscientious vagabonding merely requires informed awareness as you travel from place to place. And for all the talk about ecological and cultural sustainability, few people actually understand these concepts. Knowing your science, not your politics, is what will best inform your decisions as you tread lightly around the world. Please go to vagabonding.net/resources for more information about socially and environmentally responsible travel. Chapter 9, Be Creative. In countless caper movies over the years, the goal of the protagonist has been to steal an eye-popping sum of money, $1 million is always a good amount, and escape to some tropical paradise in a quiet corner of the world. To successfully reach this faraway Shangri-La, loot in hand, is what constitutes a happy ending, and not much screen time is devoted to what happens after. The implication here is that a stack of money and a tropical hideaway provide the ideal ingredients for personal happiness, and that nothing better could be asked from life than to sit around and drink rum cocktails until death finally claims you. As with many things cinematic, of course, this scenario is an escapist cliche, and you don't need to rob a bank to prove it. Indeed, just take a modest, non-heisted sum, $5,000 say, to a quiet, inexpensive beach in Guatemala, Greece, or Goa, and see what happens. In all likelihood, your enthusiasm for sitting around smeared in cocoa butter will run out before your money does. This is not because tropical beaches in these places are boring. To the contrary, they are some of the most beautiful and blissful spots in the world. But because what most people consider paradise is defined in contrast to the stresses of home. Take away those stresses for a couple of months, and it's hard to wring much passion or esteem from hanging out on a beach and not doing much. Few vagabonders restrict their travels to one beach scene, of course, but the point is that you can never dream up the perfect travel formula while you're still sitting at home. What seems like paradise when you're planning your travels, be it white sand beaches, archaeological wonders, or exotic textile markets, will eventually seem somewhat normal after a few weeks or months of living on the road. Moreover, so many new things will happen in the process of reaching these places that you'll probably outgrow your original travel motivations. As new experiences and insights take you in surprising new directions, you'll gradually come to understand why long-time travelers insist that the journey itself is far more important than any destination. At times, in fact, the sheer wealth of options in your journey will seem overwhelming. One of the most stressful moments on my first trip across Asia, for example, came not from some physical or emotional trauma, but from reading discount travel ads in the Bangkok Post. Every major region in the Eastern Hemisphere, I discovered, was reachable from Thailand for under $400. Within 2 days, and at no great expense, I could find myself in Paris, Beirut, Melbourne, Tokyo, Cape Town, or Bali, and embarked on a completely different and amazing new adventure than the one I was starting in Thailand. When I checked into my Khao San Road guest house that night, I could hardly sleep. Had I really made the right choice in coming to Southeast Asia? Hadn't I, after all, always wanted to see Australia? Might Africa have provided a wilder adventure? Didn't Europe promise more romance? In retrospect, I see that my stress wasn't the product of indecision. The conflict arose from my impossible desire to be in all those places at once. In knowing that so many destinations were cheaply accessible at that very moment, I suddenly feared I would never again get the chance to see them. Travel, I was beginning to realize, was a metaphor not just for the countless options life offers, but also for the fact that choosing one option reduces you to the parameters of that choice. Thus, in knowing my possibilities, I also knew my limitations. Ultimately, I learned to stop looking at my journey as one final apocalyptic chance to see the world, and started enjoying it on its own esoteric terms. As I learned to focus my travel energies onto my immediate surroundings, I eventually stretched what I thought would be a one-year Asia sojourn into 30 intense months. In this way, vagabonding is less like a getaway caper than a patient kind of aimlessness, quite similar, in fact, to what Australian Aborigines call walkabout. Culturally, the walkabout ritual is when Aborigines leave their work for a time and return to their native lifestyle in the outback. On a broader and more mythical level, however, walkabout acts as a kind of remedy when the duties and obligations of life cause one to lose track of his or her true self. To correct this, one merely leaves behind all possessions except for survival essentials and starts walking. What's intriguing about walkabout is that there's no physical goal. It simply continues until one becomes whole again. In making reference to Aboriginal mysticism, I'm not suggesting that the goal of vagabonding is to become whole. After all, wholeness implies closure, and vagabonding is an ongoing process of finding new things. You can, however, recover and discover parts of yourself psychic and emotional parts you never knew existed as you travel through the world. And as you do this, you'll also leave behind aspects of yourself, habits, prejudices, even pieces of your heart. Striking the right balance between finding yourself and losing yourself on the road, of course, requires creativity. Creativity is particularly important after you've been on the road for a long time, because inevitably you'll fall into a kind of road routine. Certain activities, sleeping, eating, reading, socializing, wandering, will become a fixture of each day. This is good and well, routines make your day more efficient after all, but you should be careful not to let your days or destinations blur together. Once this begins to happen, once you feel yourself getting jaded to the long haul, it's time to mix your travels up a bit. How you choose to do this will depend on how you've already been traveling. If you've mainly been visiting cities, for example, perhaps it's time to hit the countryside. If you've been spending most of your time in the backcountry, try a taste of city life. If you've been traveling alone, seek out new companions. If you've been traveling with a partner, split up for a while. If you haven't done much recreation yet, rent a kayak or take an open water scuba course or learn how to rock climb. If all you've done is play, maybe it's time to head out and wander with no particular goal in mind. Sometimes it's not a bad idea to take a break from your shoestring budget and indulge yourself in a gourmet dinner or a night in a luxury hotel just to see how the other half travels. At other times, buying into a crowded group tour of a local site can be an interesting and an ironically entertaining change of pace from independent travel. Occasionally, when you feel like you've overdosed on local color, you might want to catch a taste of home. One of my guilty pleasures of Bombay, for example, was watching the movie Charlie's Angels on the big screen after eating a burger at an American-style restaurant. The following day, I had nearly as much fun watching a 4-hour Bollywood musical and trying to decipher the Hindi plot. One surefire method to keep travel from getting too predictable is to occasionally acquire or improvise your own transportation. In Laos, I bought a local fishing boat with some other travelers and drove it down the Mekong River for 3 adrenaline-filled weeks. In Burma, I bought a Chinese-made one-speed bicycle in Mandalay and pedaled it south for 10 days before trading it for a fistful of pearls. In Lithuania, I stuck out my thumb on the side of the road in Vilnius and found myself 4 countries away, in Hungary, 3 days later. In Israel, I did away with transport altogether and walked across Galilee, Jesus style. In addition to being unforgettable experiences, each of these adventures ended up costing me next to nothing. I still intend to try other classic forms of self-transport, such as a used car in Australia, a used horse in Argentina, a used camel in Morocco, and an off-the-assembly line infield motorcycle in India. However or wherever you happen to travel, your experience of a place will obviously be different if you stay there for 2 days, 2 months, or 2 years. Most places you'll only be able to experience for a few days, of course. But just because you're traveling doesn't mean you must always be on the move. What dost thou think, then, of seeing the world, taunts Peleg in Herman Melville's Moby Dick? Can't you see the world where you stand? This in mind, it's advisable to pick an appealing place at some point in your travels and settle down for a few weeks or months and get to know it better. Where you choose to do this is entirely up to your whim. Perhaps you'll linger at a place you'd always dreamed of knowing. Perhaps you'll happen upon a place or a person that you fall in love with. Or maybe you'll just go on instinct. In 2.5 years of traveling the Orient, I lingered for 3 weeks or more in Bangkok, Riga, Cairo, and Pushkar. My reasons for hanging out in each location were not always that inspired. In Pushkar, for example, I was trying to get some rest and overcome a bout of stomach sickness. Rather, each experience just sort of made sense when I was living it. While wandering, you experience a mysteriously organic process, observed Joseph Campbell. It's like a tree growing. It doesn't know where it's growing next. A branch may grow this way and then another way. When you look back, you'll see that this will have been an organic development. Thus, you'll often find that your decision to linger someplace is a simple flowering of your ongoing explorations. Once you've found a special place to call your own for a few weeks or months, your options there are virtually endless, and you needn't have a concise plan going in. There are deeper reasons to travel. Itches and tickles on the underbelly of the unconscious mind, wrote Jeff Greenwald in Shopping for Buddhas. We go where we need to go, and then try and figure out what we're doing there. At the outset, you might linger in a place just to slow down, goof off, and rest up for more travel. Should you want to catch up on some reading, feel free to string up a hammock and plow your way through a stack of books. Should you have hobbies, cooking, painting, music, meditation, you might take the time to deepen and diversify such interests within an exotic new context. Should you feel more social, you might choose to wander through your adopted hometown and figure out the inner workings of the place, how the houses are made, how the food is cooked, how the crops are farmed. At times, you might even be invited to lend a hand in these activities. In the process, you can make local friends by joining in lighthearted public activities such as soccer matches, backgammon games, or afternoon cocktails. You might even learn unexpected things about local customs, religions, or values merely by observing the habitual rhythms of the day. Should aimless curiosity not fit your disposition, however, there are plenty of more structured ways to experience a destination. Many places, for example, will offer classes in local disciplines, Thai massage, Italian cooking, Indian yoga, Argentine tango, and language classes anywhere are a great way to immerse yourself in a local culture. Work is another way to deepen your experiences of places as you travel. Rarely will you find travel jobs that make you lots of money, but you should at least be able to break even on living expenses while meeting interesting people and finding unique experiences. Teaching English is a popular and easy-to-find work option on the road, but there are plenty of alternatives, many of them dealing with the labor or hospitality industries. Farm work, for example, is a common traveler's employment in New Zealand. Fruit harvest is a seasonal job option in France. Labor in kibbutz collectives, usually farms or factories, is a time-honored traveler's option in Israel. Landing a job at a hostel or resort is often an opportunity in areas of the world with heavy tourist traffic. None of these jobs are all that glamorous, of course, but they will allow you to make a bit of cash while you view certain corners of the world from a new angle. The evenings I spent working as a bar tout in Jerusalem didn't earn me much travel money, for example. But all those hours of handing flyers to disinterested pedestrians allowed me to learn humility in a way that enriched my perspective of the city. Though such work need not be arranged before you start your travels, specialty publications such as Transitions Abroad are great for finding out what short-term jobs and volunteer opportunities are out there. Should making money not be a factor, volunteer work is another great, inexpensive way to get to know a place. When I traveled across North America, for instance, none of Mississippi's tourist attractions were as memorable as the days I spent hauling concrete for a volunteer house-building project outside of Canton. Such volunteer pursuits can be directed toward randomly discovered situations as you travel, for example, briefly lending your medical, carpentry, or English skills as you come across communities in need. Other volunteer work, from building irrigation systems in El Salvador to teaching computer skills in Tibet, can be found through more formal routes, such as state agencies, religious groups, and non-governmental aid organizations. However you choose to donate your skills, try to be honest with yourself and do so out of a personal calling instead of some vague sense of obligation or patchwork political morality. Volunteer work, after all, is serious business, and you stand to harm more than help the cause if your convictions are less than true. Be patient in finding your volunteer work and be humble in doing your volunteer work. In most cases, volunteers to a certain area end up learning as many lessons as they teach. This is why volunteering is not just socially but personally useful, since it will leaven your idealism with eye-opening doses of reality. Learning about fundamental and sometimes unbridgeable cultural and historical gaps between peoples is essential, noted travel writer and ex-Peace Corps volunteer Jeffrey Taylor. One must not delude oneself that we are all alike or destined to be members of some sort of global family. Indeed, acknowledging differences and avoiding superficial cures is not just a valuable lesson of volunteer work, it's often the first step in actually solving the problems that you seek to fix. However you choose to enrich your experience of a place, be it through building a recreation center, harvesting grapes, or playing pickup games of chess at the local cafe, always challenge yourself to try new things and keep learning. In this way, you'll find that you're not just exploring new places, but weaving a tapestry of life experience that is much richer and more intricate than you could have ever imagined while you were still at home. Vagabonding Profile, The Vagabonders of Pax Islamica. Though it may be tempting to view vagabonding purely as a pastime of the industrialized West, long-term travel was for centuries a primarily Eastern art. Indeed, some of the most vivid personal accounts of vagabonding come from the 10th through the 15th centuries, when safe travel was possible within an Islamic empire that stretched from the Pillars of Hercules on the Atlantic to the Malayan archipelago of Southeast Asia. While Ibn Battuta was the most celebrated of these Arab travelers, we discussed him in Chapter 6, men like Ibn Jubayr of Spain and al-Muqaddisi of Jerusalem also wandered to the far corners of the Islamic world, gaining life experience along the way and earning their keep as teachers, lawyers, hawkers, bookbinders, papermakers, merchants, messengers, and pilgrims. Not all of these vagabonders were Muslim either. One of the most prolific travelers of the time of Pax Islamica was one Benjamin of Tudela, a Spanish rabbi whose 12th century adventures took him as far as the western border of China. In the Meadows of Gold, 10th century Muslim geographer Al-Masudi described the thirst for diverse experience that inspired the wanderers of this era. He who stays at home beside his hearth and is content with the information which he may acquire concerning his own region cannot be on the same level as one who divides his lifespan between different lands and spends his days journeying in search of precious and original knowledge. Vagabonding Voices, Chapter 9.
This is Ann Van Loen, a 43-year-old teacher from Seattle, Washington. We made it a point to volunteer whenever possible as we traveled. Working with kids at an after-school program in Peru, practicing English with high school students in Laos, volunteering full-time at an elephant sanctuary, these times allowed us to be part of something bigger than ourselves, to meet people and to participate in local communities.
This is James Ulrich, a 34-year-old freelance travel writer from Seattle. Lots of establishments, ranging from host farms, lodges, B&Bs, and backpacker hostels, invite travelers to help out in exchange for accommodation and meals. The short-term guests pitch in some light labor while getting a great big dose of the local culture. Due to the seasonal nature of agriculture, helping out on a farm baling hay, or picking grapes in a vineyard, or picking berries in an orchard, can be a great way to survive a summer abroad on a very low budget. Skills like agriculture, animal care, boat crewing, and carpentry are sought after in various pockets of the globe. Aside from the monetary savings, the opportunity to live with the locals and participate in their day-to-day life is well worth the work.
This is Lavinia Spaulding, a 43-year-old writer, editor, and teacher from San Francisco. Traveling opened my eyes to the reality that anything, from a permanent island vacation to a totally wild and wacky life, is completely attainable. In my travels, I've met countless people with different experiences. People who have lived on a beach in Bali or Thailand or Greece for several years, or who have taught in Turkey or South America. The more I travel, the more travelers I meet, which means new options are constantly presenting themselves. As a result, my mind is always entertaining 100 different possibilities.
Quotes for Chapter 9. Paul Theroux, from To the Ends of the Earth. Travel is a creative act, not simply loafing and inviting your soul, but feeding on the imagination, accounting for each fresh wonder, memorizing and moving on. And the best landscapes, apparently dense or featureless, hold surprises if they are studied patiently, in the kind of discomfort one can savor afterward. A.R. Ammons from Corson's Inlet. Scope eludes my grasp. There is no finality of vision. Tomorrow, a new walk is a new walk. Francis Galton from The Art of Travel. Powerful men do not necessarily make the most eminent travelers. It is rather those who take the most interest in their work that succeed the best. As a huntsman says, it is the nose that gives speed to the hound. Kurt Vonnegut from Timequake. Listen, we're here on Earth to fart around. Don't let anyone tell you any different. Paul Auster from Smoke. People say that you have to travel to see the world. Sometimes I think that if you just stay in one place and keep your eyes open, you're going to see just about all that you can handle. Charles Kuralt from A Life on the Road. If you really want to learn about a country, work there. Pico Iyer, Why We Travel. We travel initially to lose ourselves, and we travel next to find ourselves. We travel to open our hearts and eyes and learn more about the world than our newspapers will accommodate. We travel to bring what little we can in our ignorance and knowledge to those parts of the globe whose riches are differently dispersed. And we travel, in essence, to become young fools again, to slow down and get taken in and fall in love once more. Tip Sheet, Chapter 9. Please visit vagabonding.net/resources for up-to-date resources on overseas work and volunteering. Chapter 10, Let Your Spirit Grow. There's another story that comes from the ancient desert fathers of Egypt. In this tale, a monk named John the Dwarf decided one day that life in the monastery was too much work and didn't quite match up to his spiritual ideals. I should like to be free of all care, he confessed to his abbot, like the angels who do not work but ceaselessly commune with God. Taking his cloak and a bit of food, John the dwarf then went away into the desert. About a week later, in the middle of the night, the abbot heard a faint knock on the door of the monastery. "Who is it?" the abbot demanded. "It is I, your brother, John the dwarf," came the meek reply. "You must be confused," the abbot retorted wryly, leaving the door bolted, "for John the dwarf has become an angel and no longer lives among men." The following morning, the abbot unlocked the monastery to find a distressed John the dwarf huddled on the stoop. "Ah, it appears that you are a man after all," the clever abbot said, "and that you must once again work in order to live." In seeking to find epiphany in some ill-conceived departure from reality, John the dwarf was not the first person in history to make a spiritual fool of himself, and he certainly wasn't the last. Indeed, the modern travel scene in general has a notorious reputation for such half-baked spiritual foolery, as many wanderers tend to confuse simple exoticism with mystical revelation. The guru of the month seekers in India and the Jerusalem syndrome crackpots of the Holy Land are just a couple of vivid stereotypes from a long tradition of self-indulgent travel mysticism. Fortunately, embracing the spiritual side of travel doesn't require that you don a robe and lose your mind. What we know as personal travel, after all, is the historical legacy not of exploration or commerce, but of pilgrimage, the non-political, non-material quest for private discovery and growth. Indeed, regardless of whether or not you consider your vagabonding journey to be spiritual, self-motivated travel has always been intertwined with the personal workings of the soul. But on an even simpler level, heightened spiritual awareness is the natural result of your choice to put the material world in its place and hit the road for an extended time. Where your treasure is, your heart will be also, and your decision to enrich your life with time and experience instead of more things will invariably pay spiritual dividends. Travel, after all, is a form of asceticism, which, to quote Kathleen Norris, is a way of surrendering to reduced circumstances in a manner that enhances the whole person. It's a radical way of knowing exactly who, what, and where you are in defiance of those powerful forces in society that make us forget. Thus, travel compels you to discover your spiritual side by simple elimination. Without all the rituals, routines, and possessions that give your life meaning at home, you're forced to look for meaning within yourself. And, just as John the dwarf had to work in order to live, this spiritual process is not always free of care. Indeed, if travel is a process that helps you find yourself, it's because it leaves you with nothing to hide behind. It yanks you out from the realm of rehearsed responses and dull comforts and forces you into the present. Here, in the fleeting moment, you are left to improvise, to come to terms with your raw, true self. As prosaic and practical as this process sounds, it's actually in keeping with time-honored spiritual traditions. Jesus, after all, taught that it's pointless to look to other worldly realms for revelation because the kingdom of God is within you. The Buddha expressed enlightenment not as a mystical firestorm, but as a disassembling of the conditioned personality. The Ecclesiastes of the Hebrew tradition asserts that a live dog is better off than a dead lion because God favors what you do now. Islam asserts that the sacred is never separate from the secular and that the world itself has spiritual lessons to teach. In learning the spiritual lessons of travel, of course, you may discover that it's not always possible to share or express what you're experiencing. Religious traditions have given us certain words and metaphors to describe the numinous realm, but words are symbols, and symbols never resonate the same with everyone. Many people, for instance, saw Jack Kerouac's On the Road as a secular celebration of speed and freedom, but to Kerouac, the book was a spiritual diary. It was really a story about two Catholic buddies roaming the country in search of God, he wrote in a 1961 letter to Carol Brown, and we found him. I found him in the sky in Market Street, San Francisco, and Dean had God sweating out of his forehead the whole way. Traditional Catholics might question Kerouac's characterization of the divine, of course, but the discrepancy is more a matter of semantics than inspiration. Often, spirituality is best approached without specific lexicons or set formulas. Too frequently on the road, people seek the spiritual side of life in the same determined way they might join a gym. They want results, and they want them soon. Thus, the yoga camps of India, the meditation retreats of Thailand, and the evangelical group tours of Galilee sell out, literally and figuratively, to vacationers in search of instant spiritual gratification. In reality, there is just as much epiphany to be had in wandering lost through the alleyways of Varanasi, enduring diarrhea on the Bangkok to Surat Thani minibus, or playing games with children in the Nazareth town square. Moreover, spirituality is an ongoing process that deepens with the seasons, and those who travel the world hoping to get blinded by the light are often blind to the light that's all around them. At a certain level, then, spiritual expression requires the same kind of openness and realism that is required of vagabonding in general, particularly in culturally reversed situations, which can be found not only in distant Lhasa or Rishikesh, but in the Near Eastern confines of Jerusalem or Mount Athos. There is no god but reality, goes a saying attributed to a mythical Sufi sect, and blasphemous as this sounds, it is not a declaration of unbelief. Rather, it is a warning to avoid turning inspiration into fetish and tradition into dogma. It is an admonition to never reduce the spiritual realm to the narrow borders of your own perceptions, prejudices, and ideals. Indeed, if you travel long enough, you'll find that your spiritual revelations are invariably grounded in the everyday. A great little vignette of spiritual discovery comes from Joshua Geisler, an American musician I met in India. Though Josh originally traveled to India for its musical and mystical tradition, his very idealism is what initially kept him from growing as a musician. During his first few lessons with an Indian flute master, he would inquire only about the mystical side of the music. But as Josh told me in an email, the experienced teacher invariably steered the lesson back to the functional challenges of his art. But what about Tansen, I would ask? Is it really true that he could light a fire with his voice? With a chuckle, the master would answer, "Why sing a raga when you could just light a match?" Eventually, Josh came to realize that the flute master's very practicality, his faith in technical diligence, was what enhanced his capacity for true spiritual expression while playing music. Ultimately, then, discovering the sacred as you travel is not an abstract quest so much as a matter of perceiving, an honest awareness that neither requires blind faith nor embraces blind doubt. And, more often than not, the most singular experiences of travel come in not finding what you'd hoped to discover. In The Snow Leopard, thought by many to be the best travel book of the last century, there is ironic joy in the fact that Peter Matheson never sees a snow leopard during his adventure in the Himalayas. Thus, robbed of a climactic moment, Matheson leads us into the simple essence of his journey. The common miracles, the murmur of my friends at evening, the clay fires of smudgy juniper, the coarse, dull food, the hardship and simplicity, the contentment of doing one thing at a time. When I take my blue tin cup into my hand, that is all I do. Before you begin your travels, you might not see the spiritual significance of such seemingly mundane details. After all, a journey is a temporary diversion, and there would seem to be little reward in the common miracles it promises. That is, until you realize that life itself is kind of a journey. Vagabonding Profile, Annie Dillard. A self-described wanderer with a background in theology and a penchant for quirky facts, Annie Dillard examines the realm of the spirit through the lens of nature. Born Annie Doak in 1945 in Pittsburgh, Dillard had a Salinger-esque childhood, studying her own urine under a microscope and reading On the Road with the encouragement of her father, who himself once quit a job to travel down the Mississippi River. After suffering a near-fatal attack of pneumonia at age 25, Dillard decided that she needed to experience life more fully, so she spent four seasons living alone in the Virginia backwoods. The book she wrote about the experience, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which blends Christian spirituality with eccentric observations about the natural world, went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. In her writing, Dillard points out that curiosity about the world is the starting point for spiritual discovery and vice versa. What we know for starters is, here we are. This is our life, these are our lighted seasons, and then we die. In the meantime, in between time, we can see. The scales are fallen from our eyes, the cataracts are cut away, and we can work at making sense of the color patches we see in an effort to discover where we are. It's common sense. When you move in, you try to learn the neighborhood. Vagabonding Voices, Chapter 10.
This is Derek Orth, a 28-year-old voice actor from Florida. To me, travel represents ecstasy. I don't mean ecstasy as simply intense happiness or joy. It's much more than that. Ecstasy, or ecstasis in Greek, originally meant to be or stand outside oneself, a removal to elsewhere. That's what travel is, both physically and philosophically. When I left Florida to go to Asia, I didn't just leave a geographical location. I also left the surroundings, routines, and people that informed me who I was. Scary, but surprisingly freeing.
This is Jessica Jurassic, a 31-year-old storyteller and designer from Michigan. Travel will challenge your well-worn assumptions and accumulated habits. It will shake up your boring old patterns, make you feel every raindrop and taste every bite of mango. It will inspire you again, kindling that lost flicker of creativity until new